We'll read this passage again from Matthew 7, verses 1 to 6, kind of as the backdrop for this. This is lesson 39, if you picked it up there on the back wall. If you need it, raise your hand. Anybody need lesson 39? Does anybody have it? Up front here. This is part 5 on keeping the tongue. I told you that Bolton spends a lot of time on this, and I think we all know why. James himself says the tongue is an unruly evil. How much damage is done by our speech. So it's very important to him and important for us that he spends as much time on this as he does. Now this is the final part, and Lord willing, next week we'll begin another section, an eighth particular direction, if you will, in his book on a comfortable walk with God. Well, let us hear the word of the Lord. Matthew chapter 7. Jesus says, "Judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you." Thus saith the Lord. Okay, again, on this last section with regard to keeping the tongue, we're still unfolding what we began last time. We are to observe a sanctified silence in three things. Last week we looked at the fact that we are to observe a sanctified silence from rash censuring. Rash censuring, as Jesus describes here in these verses, Bolton says, "Let that ever be something known of the hypocrite. Let that ever be the mark of the hypocrite. Let it never be known that we as Christians behave so." Come to the second direction, the second thing, with regard to observing sanctified silence, and that is that we are to observe a sanctified silence with regard to gross slander, backbiting, and falsely accusing. We are not to slander. We are not to backbite. We are not to falsely accuse. This is not the normal behavior of Christians. This is not the way God's children behave. We know as much. We would never say that that would be okay for us to behave in such a way. We would never confess that that's the way we do behave. But at the same time, Bolton points out that regardless of what we may think about it, we can become guilty of blackening a good man's name. In other words, we can become guilty of this very thing which we know is wrong for us to do. We know it's not the characteristic of a Christian. We know it's not Christ-like. And we know it's wrong when we hear someone else do it. But Bolton says, you know what? We can actually fall into this trap. If we're not careful with our tongues, we can quickly fall into backbiting, speaking ill of someone, slandering, and falsely accusing. Now, what's difficult here, as we think about this section tonight, because we're really only going to spend time there, there's one more item, the third thing in which we are to observe a sanctified silence, but we won't have anything to say about that this evening. But what's difficult is, it's difficult to avoid this backbiting, or I should say this falling into it as a Christian, simply because we've all been injured by other people. Have we not? We've all been injured by other people. We have, in fact, injured one another. We've been injured by our neighbors. We've been injured by family members. We've been injured by close friends. The fact that we've been injured by others makes it very hard for us to not fall into this trap because of our own sinful tendencies. So, what we need to realize is we can't take what Bolton is saying and saying, okay, that's, you know, he's referring to weak Christians. He's referring to non-Reformed people, non-Presbyterian people. He's referring to Arminians. We need to be careful we don't just categorize this in some other group. This needs to be brought home to our hearts because his whole point is, as I write to you, dear Christians, he's saying, you can do this. You fall into this. Be you careful. So let's be good about applying this to our own hearts, which is, as we learned last week, this is where true zeal begins, at home, in our hearts. So now, we can fall into this sin. We can become guilty of blackening a man's good name. And this is done And he gives us four ways. First of all, it's done when we reveal his secret infirmities. When we speak about his weaknesses and sins, things which love would conceal. Love, which Paul says covers a multitude of sins, right? Things which love would conceal. And we expose a man's infirmities, a man's weaknesses, a man's weak points in his life and sinful failings, and we blabber them about. Remember what Jerry Bridges said, Mike? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it true? We're going to say something. It's part of that that really plays in this whole section, of course. When it's something, the point is, it's something that love would conceal. So it's something that doesn't need to be said. It's something that's not necessary. We need to think through it and consider whether this is something that we can and should overlook. There's many ways to deal with confrontation or deal with conflict. Many ways of conflict resolution, if you will. And one way is just simply to overlook it. In other words, overlook an offense. Someone has wronged you. It has happened. The person has treated you as they shouldn't. They spoke as they shouldn't. What are you going to do? Go tell everybody about it? Well, if it's something small enough, if it's something, not that any sin is insignificant, but something small and insignificant enough, maybe you just need to love the person, forgive the person, and say nothing. In other words, no one else needs to know about it. Why does the person next to you need to know what the person across the room did to you yesterday or last week? We need to think through that. So he says, this is done. He gives several examples as we go through this, which I thought were helpful, and they're not the only example. Other examples could be given. And this is where his mind is as he writes this. He says, this is done when we hear of a man being commended or praised for his good traits, and we insert a but. Only so that we want to be noted as better than him. You see where the problem is? As Bolton sees it, as he's laying it out, the problem is our own pride. The problem really isn't that the man did something or that the man has a wrong in his life. That's not the problem, nor is it really the issue. The issue is, you're in the room and you're hearing him be praised. And you can't stand it. Because you have aught against your brother. Because you're proud. And you refuse to let him be to appear in better light than you presently are in the same company. And so, you open up your mouth and say, actually, I probably should tell your brother something about that man. And you begin to insert those things. This is how we can become guilty of this. We reveal his secret infirmities, which our love for him would conceal. The second way is when, notice how everything is always brought to our hearts. It was pride a second ago, now it's suspicion. When from a suspicious heart, we draw out of other men's words, actions, and behavior, aims and intentions which he never dreamed of. In other words, we put a brother's words, actions, and behavior in the worst light possible. Now, he goes on and he describes, he says, you know, the law of natural reason tells us that we should judge everything in the best light. We should assume the best of one another. But beyond the law of natural reason, we have 1 Corinthians 13, right? 1 Corinthians 13, 7, love believes all things. As we said last week, love sees everything in the best light. So we are to put everything, the best construction on it possible. So 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7 demands that doubtful things be judged in the best light possible without sin. We're to give all men the judgment of charity, not the judgment of suspicion. If we're suspicious of what another brother said, if we're suspicious of what another brother did, and if we're so quick to find fault where it doesn't lie, is the problem really with the other brother's actions or words? It's not. It's with ourselves. And that's Bolton's point. It's with ourselves because we've got that suspicious heart. Why are we, as he said last time, why do we have so much time to look into others' lives to find fault? Bolton says it's because we're not spending enough time looking in our own hearts to see the fault that lies within, that beam in our own eye. A third way we can become guilty of this is when we add to the truth, detract from the truth, or intermix the truth with false glosses from our own minds in order to impute fault to a man and bring credit to ourselves, lest we be seen to have been excelled by another. Pride. We don't want a brother to look better than we are. We want to appear better than he is. We want the present company to think more highly of us than they do of him. And in a moment of him receiving all of the praise, we just can't stand it. Why can't we just in that moment deny ourselves, humble ourselves, and join the cheer? Why can't we say in that moment, actually, I do appreciate that about that brother. I do appreciate that. He's actually encouraged me along those lines in several ways. Actually, that sister's done that very same thing to me. One time she really encouraged me. Or I see that good talent in that person. Why can't we just say that? Why do we have to say, why do we have to put that but in there? Why do we have to impute things that aren't there? Why can't we just recognize the grace of Christ where the grace of Christ is? Because it's all Christ, isn't it? We know this. We're not trying to exalt a person. We don't want to get behind and praise a person. We don't want to exalt anybody. But can't we just at least recognize the goodness of God and the grace of Christ in the lives of one another? Can we not, Bolton is saying, in love, overlook a lot of things? A lot of things can be overlooked. Now, many things need to be dealt with differently. But a lot of things can be overlooked. But it's pride in a situation like that that keeps us from overlooking it, because we don't want to be excelled, and so we want to impute fault. And so we add to the truth, detract from the truth, intermingle false glosses with the truth. He gives another example. This is done when we give men their due commendations, but then we add a false word. Quote, steeped in gall and vinegar, which bites most bitterly and cuts like the sharpest razor. We should have just stopped. We should have kept our mouth shut after the first period. But we've got to go on. And he just gives a couple of instances. As if we were to say, you know, he's a man of great worth, great achievements. I agree. But he's proud. He's a very zealous man for the Lord, but I'm sorry to say he's covetous. Did you know that? What are we doing when we're talking like that about others? What are we hoping to accomplish? Are we really hoping to accomplish any change in the other person? Normally we're not. We're hoping to accomplish a change in the perception of the person to whom we're speaking about ourselves. As Bolton taught us last time, that we're so eagle-eyed that we can spot sins in anybody. That we're so careful and zealous for the Lord that we stand up against any sin, no matter in whom it must be. We're really looking out for number one, aren't we? We're not really exercising love. 1 Corinthians 13. We're not really walking in the ways of the Lord. We're judging rashly. We're backbiting. We're slandering. We're falsely accusing to save face, as it were. It can happen, fourthly, when we relate all the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It's like, well, how can you go wrong there? It comes back to the heart. But either with a malicious and spiteful heart, or in an insulting manner, or with an evil intention to throw mud on it. In other words, we give the man his due, as it were. We say nothing that isn't true, but our tone of voice is such. Or we follow it up with a slap in the face, as it were. Our motives are wrong. We get behind the parade, but we spoil all the fun. And we take everything away from that man which is due. And I'm saying man again and again because it's easy. But of course this is a she and a woman as well, right? It's anybody and everybody, dear sisters. I'm not forgetting you. So, consider therefore, as he goes on, that telling the evil that is true of another in his absence will brand you with the guilt and stain of backbiter. Except in such cases as these. And I appreciate this because now we come to the section to where Bolton says, well, or we ask him, well, are there any times where we can talk about others? Should we never, ever, ever say something? Should we never reveal a man's faults? Should we never reveal a man's sins? Maybe there are situations and occasions which it's okay and it's not sinful and we would not be guilty of backbiting when we did it. And Bolton lays out, what is it, four instances. And he had a lot to say about this. I really just shortened these up quite a bit. He really stretched these out several pages. But first of all, if you're telling a person close to him of his relapses into sin, in order that that person might interpose and do what he can to recover him from his relapse, maybe someone close that can make a difference in the person's life. Keep in your mind at this point, maybe as we read through this, keep in mind a backslidden Christian. That's really what Bolton is envisioning, I think. A Christian who is backslidden. He's fallen from the ways of the Lord. Do we say nothing? Do we do nothing? Bolton says, well, if there's someone in that person's life that you think, that you have good reason to believe, that really has an influence, maybe a close friend, a well-respected friend maybe, or an older person maybe, or a relative maybe that's a Christian as well. Maybe there's someone that you could tell his sins to behind his back, eager and encouraging that person to do what he can to intervene and recover this brother, lest he lose his soul. So the concern, the motive on our part in saying anything, Bolton assumes is good. So if we don't have backbiting motives, let's say, then maybe there's four situations in which we can say something and not find ourselves incur guilt. And this is one of them. We're hoping that the person nearer to that person than we are can intervene. Or that, again, that sister can do more than we can to bring that person back. A second occasion is, if you're trying to protect a person from being taken advantage of or deceived by him. If you hear that a person has gotten so close and thinks so much of this brother that he's on the top of the world, and you're thinking, well, wait a minute. I know that brother very intimately. I've watched him take advantage of many, many people. I've watched him take and not give. I've watched him hurt many people by his lies. Maybe that's a situation with good intention that you could warn this brother and say, you know, that brother's not above board. That brother's deceived many people by the similar speech that he gave you. Maybe then we can say something with good intentions and not find ourselves incurring guilt. The third is an obvious one. Maybe there's a situation in which we're telling an authority so that we're not seen to be an accessory to the person's evil. And we're trying to get the person help. We're trying to get help to suppress the sin which is growing worse and worse and worse. Maybe we're telling a police officer. Maybe it's a criminal thing. And we've been asked. And we say, well, maybe I shouldn't talk about this brother behind his back. Would I be backbiting him? If it's a matter of criminal action, we need to report it. We need to say something. We don't want to be an accessory to these things. The minister. Maybe we need to tell the pastor. Doesn't Jesus even lay out, go to your brother. If he doesn't repent, take two. If he doesn't repent, go to the church. In other words, go to the leaders of the church. Go to the session. Maybe the minister needs to be told what I know, because I don't think he knows. Maybe it's a parent, and we see a child slipping, and we've seen a child in places he should not be. We've seen a child do things that he's not supposed to do, and we're a covenant community. We vow to help one another raise our kids in godliness, and maybe there's something you know about someone's children that mom and dad just don't know. Maybe you need to say something. There's an instance, certainly. The fourth instance where it might be right to say something, to speak about a brother's sins behind his back, is when a seasonable, warrantable occasion is given of performing some Christian duty. In other words, if it would help us in performing a Christian duty. Now, what is he talking about? Well, he gives a few examples here. First of all, maybe we can speak about a brother's sins behind his back in an occasion of instruction and forewarning to a person who's entering a sinful course, and we may justly tell him the sins of another and warn him that he doesn't want to go on that path. We may say, you know, brother, I see you slipping. I see you falling. You know, there's another brother in the church who went the same route. He has since repented and been returned. He's returned to the Lord, but, you know, another brother went that road, and he fell hard, and he suffered many consequences. He lost this, 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 this. And if you keep going, that's going to happen to you. That's legitimate. We're not slandering and backbiting anybody. In one sense, we're saying common knowledge. Maybe not to this person, but we're sharing something in an effort to say, look, I know where this path leads. I've seen people fall in these ways. And we warn a person, and that's important. The second occasion is when we have an occasion of praising God. An occasion of praising God for the ruin and uprooting of some wicked persecutor of godliness. We're reading through Esther. We're introduced to Haman today in our reading today. What did the Jews do after Haman's death? After the death of all those who sought to kill them, they threw a feast. It was an occasion of praising God. And what were they doing in praising God? They were reporting, as it were, all of the evil deeds of that wicked Haman and giving praise to God for it. So maybe there's an occasion in this instance where we can mention the sins of another and give praise to God for it. But notice again this caveat that he has. But in such cases, look into your heart and be certain that he was an enemy to Christianity, an enemy to the church, an enemy to God, an enemy to the progress of religion, and not a personal enemy, and that your joy is sincerely out of a zeal for the glory of God's justice and not of personal vengeance. Be careful. When we read in the book of Esther, and as you know, the story unfolds, and the Jews, by another edict being established and put forth, the Jews are allowed to slay those who would slay them. But that's not personal vengeance. It's God using his own people to bring judgment. The seed of the woman bringing judgment on the seed of the serpent. It's much larger. It's not a personal vengeance. We think of David and some of the things he says in the Psalms. It sounds very personal. How can he hate someone so much? But David's the king of the Lord. King of the Lord's people. David's responsible for Israel. David stands in the place of Christ upon the throne. And he's ruler. And those who oppose Israel oppose God, because God dwelt among his people. The state was the church. And so it's not a personal vendetta. It's an enemy to Christianity that is being brought down. And so when God brings such a one down, we may indeed record and rehearse the things which this person did against God's church, and yet look at the victory that we have gained over him by God's grace. A third occasion is an occasion of prayer. In order that others might join you in praying for the person's recovery from backsliding. I think that's the one we know the most. But that's also where most gossip takes place. Sometimes this one becomes a pretense for gossip. And we begin to say too much to too many, asking for prayer, as it were. It's not that we're not sincerely asking for prayer for this person, but we need to be careful that our motive is really that this person receive prayer and be recovered from backsliding, that our motive really isn't to hang out dirty laundry for everyone to see. Sometimes our ears get tickled at gross stories of gross sin. Our ears perk up, as we talked about last time, about things like that, more than for the things of the Lord. That's just our struggle with sin. We like the gross stories, as it were. So we need to be careful. It is okay to share with another the sins of someone else if you're asking for prayer that person be recovered. But let our motives be pure. Let them be sincere in that case. And let us not be secretly rejoicing in rehearsing sinful things. And let us, as listeners, not hang on the edge of our seat for the end of the story, as it were. But let us see, as listeners, that we really have a heart for the person's soul, and that we will indeed pray and not rejoice in ungodliness. The fourth occasion is an occasion of vindicating the power and truth of religion. As when a formal professor is about to pass for a strong Christian in the company of those who know no better. Sometimes a person is being praised as being, as it were, mature, and as he says here, a strong Christian. And Bolton brought this up before. Maybe it's a situation in which we know this person more intimately than the crowd, as it were. And maybe lest others be deceived, lest the gospel be blasphemed and brought shame to, maybe we say something. And so this sub-point here, he unfolds a bit. He says, in this case, it concerns you with as much wisdom, discretion, and charity as you can possibly command. Notice how careful he is. He's a pastor's heart. How careful he is. Before he gives you, as it were, the warrant, before he gives you the okay, he prevents it, precedes it with this idea of, with as much wisdom, discretion, and charity as you can possibly command, disrobe such a fellow of his undeserved attributions and the reputation of that holiness which he never had. Be careful about your motives. Be careful of your speech. And do it with the most love you can muster, that you really have the glory of God and the honor of Christianity in mind. Lest both the bystanders be hardened to come short of heaven, because if this guy's a Christian, well then so am I. Surely I am. He's worse than I am, as it were. Now all of a sudden this man being praised in the company leads these very people astray, that they be hardened in their ways of sin because they count themselves better than him, and apparently he's a strong Christian. Or the power of Christianity be disparaged by an ignorant and hurtful undervaluation. Maybe it's where we need to stand up and say, no, God sanctifies his people. Christians do not walk as that man walks. We're not accusing, we're not backbiting, we're just simply saying that man's life is inconsistent and incompatible with Christianity, with a true relationship with Jesus Christ. That's all we need to say. That's all we need to say. But we're just preventing Christianity to be disparaged. We're preventing others as best as we can to become hardened in a course of evil themselves. So we are to observe a sanctified silence in three things. First, from rash censuring. Second, from backbiting, of which we can become guilty, even unawares. The third area in which we are to observe a sanctified silence is from all unsavory communication. Let no coarse joking, jesting, evil communication come out of your mouths. Ephesians 5:4. Look at what Bolton says. He really says just this much. I will say nothing here because such language is the language of the sons of Belial and not of any Christian. It's like, I'm not even going to treat this. I don't need to waste my time. You all know. I don't need to say any more than to remind you of Ephesians 5 verse 4. You have no business talking like a son of Belial. You are to be silent with regard to all unsavory communication. Blasphemy, swearing, cursing, immoral speech, corrupt communication, coarse joking and jesting doesn't belong in God's people's mouths. I really thought that was pretty profound. He just stated it and moved on. That's it. That brings a great punch, as it were. Well, we find ourselves then still at the end of the day, we often find ourselves in company where the communication is not what is comfortable with us. Where the communication maybe is not honoring to the Lord. What do we do? Do we always absent ourselves? Well, we can't always absent ourselves. Maybe it's work. It's co-workers. Maybe it's in a carpool, as our brother Chris was talking about. We can't always absent ourselves. So how do we handle that? How do we shine the light of the gospel in situations which we find ourselves? He ends this whole section by saying we ought to pray for and practice a holy and discreet dexterity to divert and draw from profane and wicked men, or too much worldly and ordinary talk, to more savory conversations and heavenly discourse. For in the company of profane and wicked men, are just worldly and ordinary men, ordinary talk that really is of no profit to the soul. Practice and learn the dexterity. Think of that language, the dexterity to be able to turn the conversation, to be able to take command of the conversation and divert it to another course. The conversation is a flowing stream, as it were. How do we divert those waters to another channel? Learn the art of doing that. And he gives some really good advice. Very simple. He says, first of all, it's a great pity that Christians should ever meet without having some talk of their meeting in heaven or of the blessed means and ways that lead to heaven. Yet, many times, worldly matters take up and engross too much of many golden seasons which might preciously serve to nourish and increase among them much spiritual warmth, comfort, and resolution against all ungodliness. We've talked about this many times before. We need to see that when we get together as Christians, that we have Christian talk. Right? Christian talk. That we talk in such a way that we seek, as Paul says, to build one another up. That we seek to encourage. That we reflect upon sermons preached, books read, chapters in the Bible read together in the McShane reading. That we reflect upon our hope that awaits us. The hope of being with Christ forever in heaven. It's a shame when Christians come together and have no such speech. They talk about everything under the sun. All sorts of things, and we might say not sinful things, but ordinary things that really don't profit. There's no benefit that takes place. Yes, time is spent together, but it's not been profitable time. We might even say it's been a waste of time. Because you can't always speak so with an unbeliever. In a real sense, you can't. So when two believers get together, and they don't enjoy the conversation, which only they can enjoy, then what a shame. Right? It's not that every single word, as it were, needs to be a scripture verse. But our talk should be such that it's seasoned with grace. And at the end of that conversation, however short or long it may be, we leave encouraged, we leave edified, we leave convicted, we leave comforted, whatever it may be, we leave blessed. And Christ is glorified. You remember the book of remembrance that God keeps in Malachi 3? Of those who spoke about the Lord. Well, the Lord should be busy writing in His book every time we get together. Because our speech should always be about the Lord in some respect. And especially on the Lord's Day, as we talked about before, our speech should especially be about the things of God. If the company be ungodly and contrary-minded, exercise and interpose all your wit, all your courage, all your authority and eloquence to draw them from the dunghill of rotten talk. By a wise diversion and modestly overruling transition towards some heavenly good and spiritual end. I like that description. By a wise diversion and modestly overruling transition. Turn the tables. Turn the speech. Somehow try to take control of the conversation. Not that you want to be lord of anybody. You just want to try to divert the conversation into a way in which, especially if they're unbelievers, you can plant some seeds. The conversation may quickly come back to their subject. But at least if you can divert it just for a moment, enough to turn it to the things of God, the things of the Scriptures, the things of truth, and plant a few seeds, they may yet grow. So, if we're going to be able to do this, he gives us three pieces of advice. If we're going to be able to draw people away from their rotten talk, divert them with a modest transition, divert them toward heavenly good, some heavenly good and spiritual end. First of all, acquaint yourself with the art of abstracting sacred instructions from the book of the creatures and business at hand. Spurgeon was always really good at this, right? And many have been. You can take up a number of books and just the turn of things. Just take notice of what's going on before you. Christ did this himself so many times, right? The birds of the heavens, the birds of the air, the plants, the corn, the kernel, right? All this idea when he used parables, but it's just simple, just metaphors. But the point was that he was able to take what was before him and turn it to a spiritual purpose and divert the conversation. So try to acquaint yourself, he says, with the art of doing this. Learn to read. Learn to read the hand of God in everything. And everything takes place. Political events. Everybody wants to talk about politics. Learn to read the hand of God. Bring it back to your reliance upon the Lord. Say, well, my only peace and consolation is that Christ rules upon the throne. Don't trust my president, but I trust the Lord. I rely upon God. My consolation is that God reigns. Something very simple, just to turn. And then see where that will go with the person. They may take the bait. And the conversation may go in a good direction. So acquaint yourself with the art of doing that. Secondly, have in readiness some common topics designed to stir and quicken heavenly conversation. There's a pause. There's a moment where you're on air, as it were. You've got the mic, as it were. It's your time to start the next subject. That subject's kind of dead, and there's a pause in the conversation, and someone's going to jump in with something else. Why not you? Why not have something ready? Have topics, subjects. Have something ready in mind so that you can immediately jump in and say, hey, I got a question for you guys. And boom, you come in with a new conversation. It takes thinking. It takes preparation. Above all, Get into your heart a habit of heavenly mindedness by much exercise and conversation with God in prayer. The more time you spend with God in meditation on heavenly things, the more pregnant and plentiful you'll find yourself to be with heavenly matter for conversations with men. Very, very simple. If there's garbage in, garbage will come out. You may be on the moment, right? You may have the mic and have nothing to say. You're not ready. You're not prepared. You haven't thought ahead of time, number one. But number two, if there's not enough heavenly mindedness in you, if you're not acquainted enough with the Scriptures, acquainted enough with the truths and doctrines of Scripture, if you're not acquainted enough with the God of Scripture and your own communications with God in prayer, as he says here, then what are you going to do when you've got the mic? What are you doing? It's your turn to talk. And you have the opportunity to introduce a subject in a room or in a group full of people in which the God of the gospel is needed to be heard. And we can bring that forth. What are we going to say? What are we going to do? It's a matter of being ready. It's a matter of being acquainted with the art of doing it. It's a matter of having a habit of thinking about the things of God. Be full of good things. Good in, good will come out. The mouth speaks from the abundance of the heart and the mind. If you give your mind to evil things, then when you get a chance to speak, you'll have nothing good to say. If you give your mind, as the Apostle Paul says, and you think on these things, Philippians 4:8, then when your opportunity is put before you, you'll be able to interject something positive. Who knows how the Lord might use it? It may drop like a lead balloon. But at least you are ready, you have a good account, and your conscience is clear. So you don't want to miss the opportunity. It's about redeeming the time, right? Redeeming the conversation for the good of the gospel. Okay. That's the end of that section and the end of tonight's lesson. Are there any questions or thoughts about this whole thing? We haven't covered everything. Bolton doesn't have time to unfold all the details and all of the ins and outs, but I think there's certainly been a lot here to think about with regard to how we use our tongues.
Okay. The whole series on tongues is really good.
It was a good end. I really thought he provided some very good counsel. Good.